This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The criminal investigation has stalled. For more on the story, KBOO's Bill Riley spoke with Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch.
The officer has been on paid leave for 2 years, but there's been no conviction. Is this correct?
That is true. The district attorney tried adding a charge on to supplement the assault charge that is related to a state law having to do with hunting accidents, really. And the judge told the district attorney that that wasn't an appropriate charge in this case, and the DA, for unexplained reasons, is appealing that finding. So until that works its way through the courts, there's no movement on the criminal aspect of this case.
I just want to kind of catch up on the status of this action that was taken by the grand jury in Multnomah County regarding this case.
The grand jury indictment of Officer Reister happened almost 2 years ago now. That's what we're talking about. The criminal indictment is pending because the DA has filed this appeal with a judge. That grand jury indictment was the only one in the history of the county and the city where an officer was found to possibly have violated the law using force while on duty. Unfortunately, it does not seem that grand juries in this county are giving the same scrutiny to every Portland police shooting, because this is the only one either before or after that time where there's been an indictment.
And the reason for that is what?
Well, I would say, politically speaking, it's because the district attorney doesn't want to indict the officers that he has to work with on a daily basis to put people in jail for their criminal behavior. Even though occasionally a letter will come out of the grand jury saying, tut, tut, we're very concerned about what happened here. That happened with the Aaron Campbell case, for instance. But they never go so far as to indict the officer for violating the law criminally, even as a negligent homicide or, you know, a manslaughter charge, which would be less than a murder or a homicide. And Reister is facing an assault charge because he didn't actually kill Mr. Monroe. So I gather that's why it's an assault charge and not an attempted homicide or, you know, attempted neglectful homicide case or something like that.
Do you think this is indicative of a sea change in the way that these allegations are dealt with here in the county?
I think it's an anomaly. I think that there was a lot of pressure on the city and the DA in the wake of the Aaron Campbell case, and with the Department of Justice coming in and looking over their shoulder around how they deal with people with mental illness, which Mr. Monroe does have a mental illness, and the DA wanted to make an example of somebody. And it just so happened that Officer Reister's case came along where the facts were so appalling, I guess, to the general community that, he was supposedly loaded this less lethal shotgun with five lethal rounds and fired four of them at Mr. Monroe. The fifth one jammed in the gun, and he didn't notice that there were real bullets until he started seeing the blood flowing, partly because he was firing the rounds so quickly out of his shotgun that he didn't have time to wait and see. There are several, I believe, policy violations in what I just described to you beyond the criminal aspect of this case. But I don't think it's that much more horrifying than what happened to Aaron Campbell or to Keaton Otis or to James Chassis or any of the other people who were killed by police in circumstances that the community has questioned. I just feel like it happened to be a case that the DA picked as an example.
I've been speaking with Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. This is Bill Riley with KBOO News.
Tomorrow morning, the Portland City Council is expected to appeal a jury ruling against the Portland police. Last year, a Portland jury found that city police used excessive force during a 2010 encounter with Gallagher Smith, who was awarded over $300,000. Police reportedly tased, pepper sprayed, and beat Smith before arresting him for criminal trespassing on a downtown sidewalk. Jurors found the arrest unlawful. City plans to challenge the jury's ruling in its appeal, claiming that police are authorized under city ordinances to, quote, direct pedestrian traffic. The city council resolution does not mention police conduct during the arrest. The arrest, a point of contention among concerned citizens who consider this a case of police brutality. Several activist groups are calling on the city council to take this item off their consent agenda, citing the move as a waste of public money. A demonstration against the city's decision to appeal this case is planned tomorrow morning in front of City Hall at 9 a.m.
Oregon's House of Representatives passed a controversial sidewalk bill today. House Bill 2963 allows cities to regulate sidewalks as they please. After hearing passionate testimony from the business community and civil rights advocates, only two House members voted against the bill, which now moves to the Senate. For more on the potential impact of this bill, KBOO's Sean Stewart spoke with Becky Strauss from ACLU Oregon.
The sit-lie ordinance was declared unconstitutional by the state 4 years ago. How will the House Bill 2963 compare, contrast, how will that impact?
The Multnomah County Circuit Court decision. So the decision is not binding on any other courts, but what the decision said was that the sidewalk ordinance that was in existence at that time, which is no longer the same ordinance, was preempted by the state law. So that was the basis of the ruling, that it was unconstitutional. What House Bill 2963 would do is remove the preemption. So what the Portland Business Alliance is looking to do is say that in regard to how Portland addresses sidewalk ordinances, in this case, we know we're talking about sit-lie ordinances, sidewalk management ordinances, they'd like to say that regardless of whatever protections are there at the state level, they should not apply at the local level, and Portland should come and make a new ordinance that may expand upon the sit-lie ordinance that we have now, or expand upon the enforcement that the Portland Police Bureau uses to enforce the sidewalk ordinance.
Okay, the Portland Business Association, speaking with downtown businesses, employers, passerbys, visitors to the city, in their conversation with these groups of people downtown, they were saying there is a very specific group amongst the people that were staying on the streets, and they were basically saying that it was a groups of traveling people that aren't necessarily homeless or street folks per se, and that they were creating aggressive behavior and harassing behavior with these people. Now, they were having issues, I guess, with different groups of people amongst that general culture, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting to the right point here. The ACLU has always had concerns about these types of ordinances, sit-lie ordinance. And you're hitting on that point. By their very nature, these types of ordinances are set up to target certain people in certain places. And that kind of disparate enforcement is really questionable. The city cannot go in and regulate people being rude. There may be people being rude, but there are also people utilizing our sidewalks for constitutionally protected activities like leafleting or performances or other free expression activities that should be protected.
And this is Sean Stewart with KBOO News.
Colorado and Washington states will be playing unofficial hosts to the annual 420 celebrations of marijuana that are traditionally held on April 20th. In Denver, My 420 Tours has sold 160 tour packages in which customers are picked up by limousines at the airport and dropped off at hotels that allow pot smoking on room patios. Other weekend events include lighting up outdoors at Denver Civic Center Park to celebrate marijuana legalization and the Cannabis Cup at the Denver Convention Center. In Seattle, the Dope Cup contest will give awards for the best bud, and Dope Magazine will host a party with a smoking tent and food cart. Neither state allows open and public use of the drug, but authorities usually look the other way during concerts and festivals.
A drive-by shooting occurred at 5:30 Sunday night at the intersection of North Albina and Killingsworth Streets. According to the police, a group of teens was standing at the corner when a car pulled up and opened fire. One young man was driven to Legacy Emmanuel Hospital in a private vehicle with a non-life-threatening gunshot wound. The shooting is currently under investigation by the Portland Police Department's gang enforcement team.
On Monday morning, a 39-year-old homeless man was found bleeding from the head on a park bench in Medford. The victim, Larry Singleton, was transferred to Rogue Regional Medical Center with skull and neck fractures and other injuries across his upper body. According to Medford Police Lieutenant Mike Boudreau, police do not have a suspect in custody. Medford law enforcement is canvassing the homeless community to investigate if anyone had a problem with Singleton or if anyone has bragged about the beating. Police are also unaware of when or where the attack occurred. Singleton is in critical condition. Whether he will regain consciousness is still unknown.
Last Sunday evening, Ontario, Oregon police called in the bomb squad when they suspected there was an unexploded bomb in a car in the parking lot of the local hospital. Earlier that day, two Ontario men had been brought into the hospital with life-threatening injuries caused by the explosion of a homemade bomb. No bombs were found at the hospital. Police evacuated an Ontario neighborhood while they searched the home of one of the victims. An additional search was underway in the small eastern Oregon town of Vail. The two victims, ages 59 and 60, were transported by Life Flight to other hospitals. No further information is available as federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies continue to investigate.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes guests Logan Lynn from the Q Center, talking about the center's upcoming work, as well as Tammy Wynott for an astrology recap. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock features an editorial on the Boston Marathon and interviews with journalist Ziad Abbas about Palestinian Prisoner Day and Andrea Pritcher of Cop Watch about the killing of Kayla Moore in Berkeley, California. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 61 degrees.
It's 5:15, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We just had a presidential election in which an admitted tax dodger advocated lower taxes on corporations and speculators like him, and voters rejected that idea and him. Also, polls show that about 7 out of 10 Americans think corporations should pay more in taxes than they do now, and that loopholes allowing corporations to dodge their taxes should be plugged pronto. Yet, a tiny percentage of Americans, the CEOs of huge multinational corporations, are demanding that Congress do the exact opposite of what the people clearly want them to do and instead enact those special corporate tax breaks that last year's presidential loser pushed. Whose side is your member of Congress on? You'd better check, because the corporate powers are pushing furiously for a deceptive gimmick called the territorial tax. It declares that the profits of U.S. corporations can be taxed only by the territories in which they're banked. Google is one of the giants that are hot for this scheme, for it stashed 80% of its 2011 profits in Bermuda. That's $9.8 billion Google got, not from sales in Bermuda, but from customers elsewhere. Yet it banked all of the money in this tiny territory that essentially doesn't tax corporate profits. Thus, the nifty territorial tax is Google's way of paying no U.S. income tax on those profits to support the schools, police, research, transportation networks, and other public systems that allow it to flourish as an American corporation. This is Jim Hightower saying, worse, this territorial scam is an incentive for multinational corporations to shift more of their operations and jobs out of country and to rig their books so all profits appear to be earned offshore. To learn which corporations are behind this, contact Citizens for Tax Justice, ctj.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A bill was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives on Monday in a 56-3 vote, making it illegal for an employer to request information from or access an employee's or job applicant's social media account. According to recent reports, employers in several different states since 2006 have asked applicants to log onto their social media account, such as Facebook, during interviews, friend the employer on Facebook, or the company would ask for passwords to emails and social networking sites to screen their accounts. The requests were framed as matters of public safety and employer security. Attention was drawn to Washington, D.C. back in March 2012, when two senators asked the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to investigate the legality of these requests. Employers are now restricted from requesting passwords due to House Bill 2654, which makes any type of access illegal. The bill, however, does not protect a person's social media participation if it is made public or if there is an active police investigation. Oregon is among at least 33 states this year where lawmakers have introduced bills to prevent employers from requesting passwords to personal internet accounts.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 16, 2013. At least 8 Palestinians arrested by Israeli soldiers and clashes between troops and youth reported in southern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Tuesday midday, Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinian nonviolent protest at Nasser Salah ad-Din Street near Jerusalem's Old City. Protesters were marking the Palestinian Nakba, the day Israel was created in 1948, and thousands of Palestinians were killed and expelled. Residents said that soldiers used tear gas and batons to stop the march. Soldiers also arrested 5 protesters. 3 were freed a few hours later. Also on Tuesday at noon, Israeli soldiers fired rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas at residents of Budros village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. The villagers gathered to mark the 9th anniversary of the death of a villager who was killed by the Israeli army. According to residents of Budros, the Israeli army attacks them nearly every day since soldiers killed a boy from the village on his way back home in January of this year. Elsewhere, many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli soldiers invaded the village of Al-Khadr near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem and clashed with local youth. Local sources said that soldiers fired tear gas at school children. When the children responded by throwing stones at them, Israeli forces invaded the village and fired tear gas at residents' homes. In addition, soldiers fired live rounds at water tanks that feed some homes with drinking water and damage them, villagers reported. Earlier on Tuesday, the Israeli army conducted a number of drone invasions targeting West Bank communities, searched homes and arrested 3 Palestinian civilians. Invasions and home searches were reported in Hebron, Nablus and Ramallah cities. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, April 16th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
Yesterday, the consumer interest group Public Citizen issued a report questioning some basic claims made by supporters of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline would stretch from the tar sands oil reserves in Alberta, Canada, to the Gulf of Mexico and would be operational by 2015. Supporters allege the pipeline would help reduce American gas prices, boost national energy security, and create thousands of construction jobs. The Public Citizen report contends that the Keystone Pipeline is actually designed to divert oil from U.S. markets and refineries. Gas prices would consequently rise, especially in the Midwest, where much tar sands oil is currently refined and directed into the domestic market. By contrast, the Gulf Coast refineries to be fueled by the new pipeline are increasingly export-oriented due to the stagnating U.S. fossil fuels market. The pipeline essentially allows Canadian oil to bypass the U.S. in favor of overseas markets, including China, where interest in tar sands oil has increased in government and investment circles. The Keystone Pipeline would also transport fossil fuels from the booming Bakken region of Montana and North Dakota. The report says this situation is good for China and Canada, but not for U.S. energy security. President Obama is expected to decide whether to issue or deny a presidential permit for pipeline construction this year.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters Local 728 sanitation workers are on strike in Georgia against Republic Services Allied Waste. The union says it's an unfair labor practices strike to protest the company's violation of federal labor law. The workers are trying to get their first collective bargaining contract. Jamar Branch says that since a merger, he and other workers work longer hours, do more work, and had their pay cut. He says Republic Services Allied Waste isn't respecting workers.
You know, I'm standing up for what I believe is right, and I'm willing to stand on it, as long as it takes. Whatever it takes. For me, myself, and my fellow employees, I would like to see other men, workers, get treated fairly and at least get paid the same as other Republic workers.
From the Teamsters picket line in McDonough, Georgia, Hugh Vample says the company isn't respecting its workers and isn't acknowledging the struggle for dignity and respect for sanitation workers that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. died defending.
I'm proud that we're doing what we're doing. At this point, and if there's anybody or any other corporation that's having the same or similar situation, that they have to stand up for what they believe in. I mean, it's a good thing as far as your family, your kids. It's the right thing to do, and never let any organization really make you feel less than the man that you are.
The Blue-Green Alliance Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference kicks off in Washington, D.C. today. The alliance consists of environmental, labor, and science groups. The conference will look at climate change issues and how that impacts infrastructure rebuilding, how to build a truly green future while providing the needed good jobs, the American Green Manufacturing Renaissance, and how to make the Blue-Green Labor Environmental Alliance actually work on the ground to advance a green economic future for America. The House is scheduled to vote on Republican-penned legislation which could see federal workers terminated if they have a tax lien with the federal government. Jesse Russell reports.
The Federal Employee Tax Accountability Act also requires prospective employees to certify that they have no delinquent tax debt. Federal employees with tax debt has been on the rise since the start of the recession, and it jumped significantly in 2011, the same year a federal pay freeze kicked in. That pay freeze was recently extended for a third year. It also comes on top of hundreds of thousands of federal employees, possibly facing a pay cut as high as 20% due to furloughs triggered by sequester cuts. According to numbers released by the Internal Revenue Service, federal workers have a delinquency rate of 3.2%. The delinquency rate for non-federal workers in the United States is 8.2%. The number of tax delinquencies among employees of the House of Representatives is above average at 3.7%. According to the Washington Post, additional data from the IRS show that only 0.4% of federal employees currently have tax liens.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sean Stewart, Sam Bowman, and Bill Riley. The producer is Sequoia Wright. Our engineer is Andrew McEwen, and the KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Alex Ward.
And I'm Ren Green. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Lisa Loving speaks with Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation Executive Director Sharon Gary Smith about their upcoming annual fundraiser, Justice Within Reach, and the giving economy that keeps many community services and groups afloat. At 9 on Political Perspectives, we hear Mark Brenner, Director of Labor Notes, speaking on new directions for labor at the Portland Troublemaker Schools this past weekend. At 9:15, we hear an excerpt from Economic Update with host economist Richard Wolf, who interviews journalist and activist Chris Hedges on the deepening social crisis, divisions, and turmoil coming. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And 11, on The Food Show, Andrew Gunther of Animal Welfare Approved talks about grass-fed beef, chickens, and genetically engineered salmon. Author Sarah Matheny talks about her new cookbook, More Peas, Thank You. And Catherine Doomling from Cook With What You Have talks about beans. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still support us by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker-Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Ren.
Good night, Alex.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 16th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, after two explosions at the Boston Marathon, area hospitals continue to treat the wounded, residents plan vigils, and authorities expand an investigation into the attack. In New York, parents and students boycott high-stakes testing across public schools. And a report finds the U.S. government authorized and used torture following the September 11th terrorist attack in violation of the Constitution. It calls for transparency and accountability. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Boston authorities confirmed today that three people are dead, including a child, and more than 170 people are injured after two explosions yesterday in Boston. Chuck Rosina reports.
Monday's tragic attack on the Boston Marathon turned a glorious celebration into instant shock and horror. The city is still reeling in the aftermath, with 12 square blocks closed to traffic and a heavy police presence. President Obama addressed the nation again this morning.
The American people refuse to be terrorized, because what the world saw yesterday in the aftermath of the explosions were stories of heroism and kindness and generosity and love. Exhausted runners who kept running to the nearest hospital to give blood, and those who stayed to tend to the wounded, some tearing off their own clothes to make tourniquets. The first responders who ran into the chaos to save lives. The men and women who are still treating the wounded at some of the best hospitals in the world. And the good people of Boston who opened their homes to the victims of this attack and those shaken by it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina, Boston.
We'll have more on the Boston blasts later in the newscast. A group of U.S. senators introduced a long-awaited proposal on immigration reform today. While the plan does map a path to citizenship for U.S. residents without legal status, the route is long and costly. And Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions said he's against it.
Really, I mean, I'm opposed to I don't think that's necessary. And actually, I don't even think they would have been asking for it. I think that's the Democratic Party.
The proposed measure includes $4.5 billion for border security to cover personnel and equipment, including drones and fencing. People living in the country without legal status could apply for Registered Provisional Immigrant, or RPI, status, but not until the entire southern border is 90% secure, as defined by the number of apprehensions. Those with RPI status would be able to legally work and travel outside the U.S., but would not qualify for social services. After 10 years, they could apply for a green card, and 3 years later, citizenship. The House is expected to release its immigration plan soon. The son of Senegal's former president is in jail today. Karim Wade is accused of corruption while he held multiple cabinet posts during his father's 12-year rule. Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
Karim Wade simultaneously held a number of cabinet posts under his father's presidency from 2000 to 2012. Wade was in charge of huge energy and infrastructure projects under budget. Wade's assets are valued at almost $1.5 billion and include a number of foreign companies, including Dubai Port World, a Moroccan bank, and an airport ground support company. He is accused of amassing his formidable wealth through illicit gains during his time in office. His lawyers submitted thousands of documents to the court yesterday just before his arrest. Wade is also under investigation in France following a complaint from Senegal regarding financial transfers. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
Dozens are dead in Pakistan today after a powerful earthquake in neighboring Iran, the strongest in the region in nearly 50 years. Iranian officials declared a state of emergency following the 7.8 quake centered in the country's southeast. State media report the epicenter was very deep and was located in a sparsely populated region of Iran, but rescuers are still trying to reach remote areas. The tremor was felt in cities around the Persian Gulf coast and as far away as India. It's the second earthquake in southern Iran in a week. Last Tuesday, a 6.1 earthquake struck near the country's only nuclear power plant. No damages to the facility were reported. In Japan, a court refused to shut down the country's only two operating nuclear reactors. Anti-nuclear activists had requested an injunction because the Oe power plant is located on a fault line. It's not clear if the fault is currently active. And the Venezuelan government claims they foiled a coup attempt organized by opposition candidate Enrique Capriles and blamed him for Monday night's violence, during which seven people died. Irina Caselli reports from Caracas.
Few details are known about the seven people who the government said died on Monday night. Two were a couple who lived near Caracas. The rest reportedly died when protests across the country turned violent. In a national TV broadcast, Nicolas Maduro spoke of a chronicle of a coup foretold, comparing the unrest to a 2002 coup that deposed Hugo Chavez for 2 days. Maduro blamed the violence on Capriles,